So there was something else that happened this week that I was quite excited about, but I didn't want to interrupt and kind of tell everybody. And it's a little bit of a story. So some of you were here over the summer for EML, and we talked some then about the situation of the Bhikshuni ordination in the Tibetan tradition. So let me give a little bit of history for the people who weren't here. Once upon a time, about 2,600 years ago, the Buddha began to ordain people. So he began first, there were some men who requested ordination. And he said, "Kamo Bhikkhu," and that was the ordination ceremony, and they got ordained. And about 6 years after that, he went back to see his family, in Kapilavastu, and he taught there. And then, as he was leaving, his aunt, who was also his stepmother, because his mother had died right after he was born, she wanted to ordain, and she went and asked him for permission, and his initial response was no. And then the Buddha left, and he went to Vasali, which is quite a ways away, because Kapilavastu is on the Nepali-Indian border. Vasali is, near Patna. So it's quite a long way. So Mahaprajnapati, that's her name, stepmother and aunt's name. There were 500 other Sakyan women who also wanted to ordain. So they weren't going to take no for an answer. So all 500 of them shaved their head and put on robes, and they started walking towards Vasali. Now, this must have been quite a sight. Can you imagine this? 500 women in like orange clothes and shaved heads walking across India together, and barefoot. It was not easy. It was quite difficult for them. And I should tell you, when I'm telling this story, don't think, oh, this is about nuns and, monastics, and it has nothing to do with me. This has a lot to do with you, okay? Because you look at the way other people practice, and you get some inspiration for your own practice. And also, it has to do with the existence of the Sangha. And because the Sangha community, the monastic community exists, Buddhism is able to carry on from generation to generation. You see, in the countries where it died out, it's because they destroyed the monasteries. So having the Sangha community, the monastics, is quite important. There's a physical center where people can go to, and also there is an obvious discipline and an obvious presence. There can be many great lay practitioners, but when you're a lay practitioner, you blend in. And if you're not a great lay practitioner, if you're a mediocre one, there's a lot of ways in which you can kind of skirt your ethical discipline, because nobody knows you're a practicing Buddhist. You just blend in. You do what you want to. Nobody knows. When you're monastic, you can't do that. Okay? So the monastic community is important, whether you ordain or not. Whether somebody's a monastic or not, the monastic community is important for the existence of the Dharma. Okay? So let's go back to our story. So there they are, these 500 women, walking across India barefoot to get to Vasali. And they come again to where the Buddha is, and Ananda is the Buddha's attendant. And they request Ananda, please ask the Blessed One if we can ordain. And he did, and again the Buddha said no. And then they asked again. These women were not going to take no for an answer. They knew what they wanted. They really wanted to practice the Dharma. They knew that keeping their morality was the best way to do it, and they were determined. So I think that says something about kind of how to cultivate ourselves. So anyway, so then they asked the third time. So then Ananda went and asked, you know, a third time to the Buddha. And the Buddha again hesitated. And most people take this as, oh, the Buddha didn't want to have nuns and, you know, women are inferior and blah, 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 blah. But I don't take this story this way. I think it was actually kind of a setup on the Buddha's part, because then Ananda asked the Buddha, well, can women get enlightened? And the Buddha said, yes. So then Ananda said, well, why can't they ordain? So the Buddha said, got a good point there. So then he ordained Mahapasupati. So I think, you know, his refusing at first gave the opportunity for that important question to be asked by Ananda about women's capability and get that cleared up with everybody. Okay, so then Mahapasupati ordained. And then presumably the bhikshus, the monks' community, ordained the other 500 Sakyan women, and they all became bhikshunis, fully ordained nuns. Okay, so the Sangha community, you know, passes down from generation to generation, and the ordination has to be given in a very particular way, you know, because when you ordain, it's not a relationship between you and your teacher, just. You know, that relationship is very, very important. But you're entering a community, so you take ordination from the Sangha community. So it's one of the major procedures that the community does, is to admit new members. So as Buddhism spread throughout India and then into Sri Lanka and in different places, you know, they didn't have email and fax machines and things like this. And everything was passed down orally. So the whole list of the vows, everything, you know, everybody just memorized it and passed it down orally. And so what you had happen after some time was this individual lineages, the individual Vinaya or Dharma lineages that gave the ordination and that had, you know, maybe they had some particular sutra that they really relied on or some particular practice that they really emphasized or some particular interpretation that was theirs. So there became 18 of these, after some time, 18 of these subsections, which is completely natural. I mean, look how many Protestant denominations there are. You know, 18 was not many. So, and it's incredible when you compare the Vinaya, that the Vinaya is the monastic discipline, and the Pratimoksha is a section of the Vinaya which lists the vows. There's so much incredible similarity among these different schools, even though everything was just passed down orally for centuries. Anyway, some of these Vinaya traditions and Dharma, Vinaya lineages and Dharma traditions kind of died out with time. You know, they rearranged themselves and became part of other, you know, small groups and so on. But some of them stayed on, and so there's three main Vinaya lineages now. There's the one, the Theravada lineage, which is, you know, in Sri Lanka and Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, part of Vietnam. There's the Dharmaguptaka, and that is in China and Korea, Vietnam, where else? Yeah, that whole East Asia area. And then there's the Mula Srivastavada, which is in Tibet. Okay, so those three particular Vinaya lineages. Now, what happened over time is, you know, because we live in the world and we're influenced by history and politics and economics and so on, is that some of the lineages had some trouble sustaining themselves. So, for example, in the 9th century, in 842, the King Lang Dharma in Tibet, you know, just kind of wiped out the monasteries. Dharma went into a decline. You know, he persecuted for a number of years. And there weren't enough monks to give the monks ordination. And so they asked two or three Chinese monks to join together with the Tibetan monks, because you need 5 to 10 monks to give the ordination. And so, you know, the Chinese monks came and joined with the Tibetans and gave the ordination, and so the monk's ordination was able to continue in Tibet. We don't really know what Vinaya lineage those Chinese monks had. Nobody really knows that. But anyway, they came together with the Tibetans and passed it on. The Bhikshuni lineage, for the women, it never went to Tibet, because to give it, you needed 10 to 12 women. And so for the women to walk across the Himalayas to India to get it, or for the Indian women, you know, nuns, to go to Tibet, it was really quite difficult. So there were a few odd, you know, women who took the Bhikshuni ordination, but as a whole, you know, that Sangha was never transplanted into Tibet. It did go to Sri Lanka, though. The famous Buddhist king Ashoka, his daughter was a Bhikshuni, and she brought the Bodhi, a stem from the Bodhi tree, a sapling, you know, that got the planted in Sri Lanka, and they still have it now. And then, you know, she brought the Bhikshuni lineage. Some more nuns came with her, and they were done. And when the Dharma went to China, you know, the Bhikshu lineage for the men, you know, got instituted. And then some nuns wanted to ordain, and they didn't have any nuns there to, you know, because the monks are ordained just by the male community, by other monks. The nuns have to be ordained with a dual ordination, monks and nuns. So there weren't any nuns there in China at that time. This was in end of 4th century, beginning of 5th century. So one Indian monk gave permission for her to just, this one nun, to ordain from the Bhikshu Sangha alone. And then in the meantime, they wrote to Sri Lanka and they invited a group of Sri Lankan Bhikshunis to come to Taiwan, and they did. And then they gave the ordination there. And so then you had the dual ordination supplanted into China, and then it continued on from there. Buddhism went to I forgot to mention about Japan. It went to Japan, and they initially had monastics, but then the government wanted to break the power of the monastics and the power of the Dharma. So in the middle of the 19th century, they decreed that the monastics had to get married. So it completely broke the power of the monastic institution. And so now they do not have the Vinaya lineages. They take the Bodhisattva vows. And so that's why in the Zen centers, they have priests, but they don't keep celibacy. You know, they're married and so on, because they don't have the Vinaya lineage. Okay. So then you had, the bhikkhu, the monk's ordination, go to all these different countries. And then in the nun's ordination, it went to Sri Lanka and then into China, to Korea, to Vietnam, you know, a few sprinklings into Tibet. It never made it into Thailand. And it actually, in I think it was the 10th or 11th century, there was a lot of civil war and violence and invasion and stuff in Sri Lanka. And so the Bhikshuni lineage died out at that time. And the Bhikshu lineage did as well. And they had to invite monks from Thailand to come to Sri Lanka to help give the ordination to reinstitute the Bhikshu lineage in Taiwan. But Thailand didn't have any nuns, so they couldn't invite the nuns to come. So then there were no more nuns in Sri Lanka. Okay, so this situation has existed for a long time. And if you look at the countries where the Bhikshuni lineage exists, there's a great difference between the ability for the nuns to practice there than compared to countries where it doesn't exist. Okay? Because when you're a Bhikshuni, you're a full member of the Sangha. You know, and I know for me, taking that ordination completely changed my Dharma practice. I had been a Shamanerika, a novice, you know, because that ordination never had gone into the Tibetan tradition. I'd been a novice for 9 years, you know, and taking it just completely changed my Dharma practice. Becoming a Bhikshuni did completely change things. Anyway, if you look in Taiwan or Korea, you know, or Vietnam, where the Bhikshuni lineage exists, the nuns are very well educated, they're teachers, they run their own communities, they do a lot of social service work. There's some really incredible nuns in Taiwan. There's one who started, her name, Venerable Chen Chung Yen, started the Sushi Foundation. It's an international organization that offers aid and service to the poor and needy. They've built hospitals. They do incredible welfare work. There is a waiting list to do volunteer work in the hospital she built in Taiwan. You want to be a volunteer, you have to go on a waiting list. Okay? I mean, that's the kind of thing that she's done. So the nuns have radio stations. They're really on top of things. Okay? You look in the Tibetan tradition. Until this generation, the nuns have not really had a whole lot of education. They've done, you know, they get kind of some teachings, and then a lot of them, you know, keep their novice vows and live in community. A lot of them in Tibet before 59 went up in the mountains and did retreat and, you know, did mantra recitation and so on. But they never kind of became a strong presence in the community. They never were able to do the debating and philosophical studies. And it's only been under the influence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama in this generation that the nuns have begun to do that. When I first went to Dharamsala, the nuns did not do those studies. You know, and it was impossible. I mean, when I first learned the Dharma, I thought, because this was presented as, you know, like how to go about it, I thought, I want to do these studies. You know, I want to do debating and stuff like that. I had no idea that they didn't let women do it. You know, and then I was like, oh. Yeah. So anyway, so that's changing, and now, you know, the women are starting to do that. They're doing the training for the Geshe degree. It's going to be very interesting because now some of them have reached the level where the Vinaya is the last topic they do. They're ready to do that class. But in the Tibetan tradition, you're not allowed to study the Vinaya unless you have the full ordination. So the Geshe's are saying, look, we can't teach you Vinaya. And of course, without Vinaya, then you can't become a Geshe. You know? So there's this going on. And then, you know, if they you know, are able to study the Vinaya, then who's going to give the Geshe degree? Because right now, only Ganden Drepung and Sarah can give it. You know, and they won't admit nuns into any of those monasteries. There's this brilliant German nun who's been studying up at the dialectic school for years. Brilliant woman. A nun, you know, wanted to go down and study in the south to see South India, where she could do, you know, the Abhidharma and the Vinaya and, you know, prepare for Geshe exam. They wouldn't accept her in the monastery because it's only for men. You know? So there's this kind of thing going on. So the Bhikshuni ordination has become a much more important issue now because it depends on these women being able to get the Geshe degree also. Okay? If you look at the situation of the women in Sri Lanka, and in, you know, there they hold 10 precepts. Again, you know, they have very little status. They do live together and they study some. Their situation is a little bit better than in Thailand. In Thailand, they take 8 precepts and they're not really considered nuns. They're called Maichi, so they could be called nuns, but they don't have the same benefits that the monks get from the government because they're not considered monastics. But also, they're not exactly lay people either. So they're in between. They mostly work at the temples and take care of the monks. You know. So this has been the situation for a number of years, and then now things are beginning to change. Okay. So in 1997, there were, I think, about 6 nuns who had the 10 precepts from Sri Lanka, who went to India and met with some Koreans, And I don't know if they took the dual ordination or not from both the monks and the nuns, but they did receive the Bhikshuni ordination. Okay, and now I have to describe here, you know, cause I was saying that the nuns need the dual ordination. Well, in Korea they do keep with the system of the dual ordination. In China, there was some interruption to that, but the system was always there where the monks gave the Bhikshuni ordination. So if it wasn't a dual ordination, the monks gave the ordination. And as far as the Chinese were concerned, that was a valid ordination, and so their lineage of Bhikshunis, you know, came down to this day. Anyway, let's go back to Sri Lanka. So these women went to India, met with the Koreans, about six of them, got the Bhikshuni vows, and went back to Sri Lanka. The next year, 1998, one Chinese master organized a huge ordination ceremony in Bodh Gaya. You know, for monks and nuns, there were some monks, mostly nuns, getting ordained. And it was very interesting because he had an international, the monks and nuns, he gave the dual ordination. So the ordaining sanghas were quite international. Okay, so amongst the Bhikshu Sangha, there was like one Thai monk, there were some Sri Lankan monks, you know. So even though in Sri Lanka, it wasn't kind of totally kosher, you couldn't have the Bhikshuni lineage, there were a few monks who were supportive who went to India and joined in this process. In the Bhikshuni Sangha, there were Chinese, there was Korean, and also Venerable Lakshya Somo and I were in the ordaining Bhikshuni Sangha. And so then there were about 20 Sri Lankan, you know, nuns who had the 10 precepts, who came there to take the Bhikshuni ordination. So they took the Bhikshuni ordination. It was beautiful, you know, because the ordination had initially gone from Sri Lanka to China, and now it's going from China back to Sri Lanka, you know. And so then they went back to Sri Lanka. And, you know, there was, of course, a big hoopla because some conservative elements amongst the monks weren't very happy. But then other monks were very supportive. And they actually said to the nuns, because the nuns, you're supposed to be ordained in different Vinaya lineages. It's either 10 years or 12 years, you know, before you can give the ordination. But some of the monks said, this is a special situation. We don't have any Sri Lankan Bhikshunis ordained long enough. You nuns can start to give it. We're going to all give the dual ordination. And this is a special situation, and you can do it. And what's very interesting when they did this, because the monks had, of course, the Theravada lineage. The nuns had ordained in the Dhammaguptaka lineage from the Chinese tradition. Okay? So then, well, which vows do they get? You know, the Theravada Bhikshuni vows or the Dharmagupta Bhikshuni vows? And they just decided, look, we're all going to do it in the Theravada. So even though these nuns were ordained in the Dharmagupta tradition, the monk Sangha was Theravada, they all decided the new nuns are going to get the Theravada Bhikshuni vows. And so they gave them, and so there's several hundred Theravada Bhikshunis now in Sri Lanka. And this just happened in the last few years. Okay. Then you had about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, some of you have heard of Venerable, before she wasn't Venerable, she was just Chetsumangkhaba Singh. She was a professor and very, you know, active in, you know, women's issues and so on in Thailand. She went to Sri Lanka and took the Shramanarika ordination, that's the novice ordination, came back to Thailand. There was a big hoopla because she came back wearing Theravada robes. She went the next year and back to Sri Lanka, took the Bhikshuni ordination, came back still wearing Theravada robes, and then the monks really, you know, you know, it was like all over the media, and there was such a big thing. Yes?
Just one question. I don't ask you. Who went? Was a student of Kamal Singh or what?
No. Dr. Kamal Singh went to Sri Lanka. And she took the novice ordination, and then she took the Bhikshuni ordination, and then she went back to Thailand. And if she had gone back wearing you know, what they call Mahayana robes, nobody would have said boo. But she went back wearing Theravada robes, and they're like, you know. So, you know, Thailand, because it's very conservative there and very patriarchal, you know, so there was a big, you know, blow up. And she just, you know, set up a monastery, you know, and she has 12 women who are going now to Sri Lanka to take ordination. I'm not sure if they're taking Shramanerika or Bhikshuni. I don't know, but, you know, more are joining. But when I was in Thailand in October, I discovered there's not a whole lot of interest there. I mean, among the monks, there's, like, no interest. It's an interesting system because the women have become so accustomed to their role in Thai Buddhism that most of them don't even think about changing it. You know, it's like, this is our role, this is what we do. We serve the monks and create merit, and that's it. Anyway, let's go back. You know, we've been traveling around the world, all these different traditions. Back in the Tibetan tradition, okay? So I think the first first Bhikshuni in the Tibetan tradition in modern times, I think was Frida Beatty. She was this one English woman who set up a school for the Tulkus in exile, where Lama Zopa went and Trungpa Rinpoche went there. Must have been a really incredible place, you know. Can you imagine all these young Tulku? And she's quite an incredible woman. So I think she was the first one. And then there were a few people here and there. You know, Pema Chodron went and took it, I don't know when she ordained. Do you know, early 70s, late 60s? Okay, so it must have been in the mid-70s. Yeah, and then Tenzin Palmo went to Taiwan. And there were a few Tibetan nuns from Chilokpur who went and took the Bhikshuni ordination and then came back. But, you know, there were just a handful of them. And, you know, when you're Tibetan and do this, the monks, you know, it was very hard for them. So I'm not kind of sure what really happened to them. But what the situation for the Western nuns, it's easier for us to go there and take it because we're not Tibetan, you know, because in the Tibetan nunneries, I mean, it's the Tibetan community. And from the side of the Tibetans, us Indies, us Westerners, we're not part of their religious institution. You know, we can come and study there, we can make donations, but we're not part of their religious institution. So what we do is, you know, it's kind of, well, it's the Indies, you know. It was interesting because for years I felt kind of like really bad, like, you know, I'm not, this is my tradition and I'm not part of, you know, part of it. But now I realize actually it was good. Because I was able to go to Taiwan and take the, you know, the Bhikshuni ordination. So Lakshay Selma, she and I took the Shramanera in the same year in 77, and then in 83 she went to Taiwan to take Bhikshuni and came back. And then the following year there were a couple of Australian nuns who went to take it. And they came back to Dharamsala wearing Chinese robes, saying, we're Bhikshunis, making a big deal. It did not go over very well. You know, when Lakshay came back, she just kind of came back, continued her studies, didn't do a big thing, you know. So she kind of blended in. But so we learned from that thing, you know, you don't come back and make a big deal. So then in 1985, Champa Sadrin went, and then I went in 86. Yeah, 85 she went, 86 I went. And there were, Siltram Palmo went. And then, you know, there were a few others who went. in the Tibetan tradition? Actually, there's not a lot of us. But, you know, then in, when was it, 1989, 1990, in Shilai Temple in California, the same master who gave one in later in 98 in Bodh Gaya, he gave one in California, and then several Western nuns in the Tibetan tradition took it at that time, and then over the years, then some of them went with the Vietnamese tradition, maybe with Thich Nhat Hanh's group, or in Paris there was a master who ordained, and so, you know, you had various people, women in the Tibetan tradition, take it, because the only extant Vinaya lineage for the women is the Dharmaguptaka, so that's in Korea and China and Vietnam, so doesn't matter which lineage you get it, I mean which place, which community you go to, it's all the same lineage. Okay, so now there's, you know, a number of us. Yeah, actually there's a number, and then there was another ordination ceremony in Los Angeles, you know, a couple of more over the years, so, you know, it's increasing. And there's been, you know, Venerable Lekshe, I think, kind of was the initiator of this, you know, spoke to His Holiness, you know, way back in the mid-80s about, you know, let's see if we can introduce the tradition into the Tibetan tradition. We've never had Bhikshunis to be a central country, you know, and the meditation on precious human rebirth is the thing of being in a central country. You have to have the fourfold community of Bhikshus, Bhikshunis, and then laymen and laywomen. So, you know, look, let's make the Tibetans a central country. And so they started in the mid-80s in the Department of Religious and Cultural Affairs doing research about the Bhikshuni lineage. And because they thought we have to, you know, research it and make sure the lineage is very completely kosher, that it's never been broken, and, you know, there was a lot of resistance to it. But it came, the way the resistance comes out at is, or as, is we have to check and make sure the lineage is valid. Okay. Now, from the Chinese part, their Bhikshuni lineage is totally valid, even though for a while it was only given by the Bhikshu. Still, it was, you know, as consented to by the Sangha, and everybody accepted it. Well, the Tibetans, you know, it's like, well, you know, maybe the lineage is broken, if not this, and how are we going to, you know, you're Dharmaguptaka, and Lamavasvapastabhada, and the monks alone can't give the ordination, and so then we can't really, you know, take it from, you know, we can't give it, and, you know, and we can't have the nuns from the Chinese tradition come with us and give it, and but we've got to research it, you know, because they couldn't say no. You know, because you can't say no, because then all your Western benefactors are going to throw a fit. But you can't say yes, because the conservative elements in the community, it's a profound change to the whole religious social structure. Okay? But of course you can't talk like this within the community there. Okay, I mean, boy, I would never say this. So it's been in they've been researching it for, you know, over 20 years now. No conclusions, you know, that's it. Okay, so where do we go from here? Okay, so it's becoming more talked about, more discussed, and for years, you know, kind of keep on nudging the Department of Religious and Cultural Affairs. And when we had the program Life as a Western Buddhist Nun 10 years ago in Bodh Gaya, you know, Venerable Tashi Sering, the monk who was doing the research, came and met Venerable Wu Yan. She's the author of Choosing Simplicity, you know, who was there and talked about it. And, you know, a lot of talk and no action. Okay. Well, in June of this year, in public teachings in Dharamsala, His Holiness starts saying, we've been doing research on the Bhikshuni lineage a very long time, and it needs to be concluded. Boing! God. You know, and because His Holiness has been supportive of it all along. Before I went to take the ordination, I went and asked His permission, and He gave it, you know. So on an individual level, He was very happy to give us permission. But He kept, and He's been saying for years, that, you know, He's not like a pope. He can't just, like, make a decree and then everybody's going to give it, because this is a matter of the Sangha, and the Sangha needs to make things, decisions together as a community. It's a community decision. So He's been saying for years that we have to have a conference of, you know, from all the different traditions and get everybody together and talk about it. And He's been saying this for years, and for years I've been saying, you know, I doubt this is ever going to happen. Because, you know, there's so much resistance in some of the Theravada countries. Or not resistance, or just lack of interest. You know, so just plain old lack of interest. You know, how are you ever going to have a big meeting when everybody decides this together? And also there's so many different opinions. How are they going to reach a big thing? But His Holiness has been saying this for years, and so I kind of took it as part of this thing of, you know, you can't say yes and you can't say no, even though He's encouraging it on an individual level. But then when He said it publicly in June, everybody went, whoa! You know, and then in Switzerland, they had a big meeting after His teachings in Switzerland in August. They had a big meeting with representatives of all the Dharma centers there. And again, His Holiness, you know, brought it up. And He said, you know, we need to, you know, get some resolution on this. And Venerable Trungpa Sajjen, the German nun, was sitting there. And he looked at her and said, I think the Western nuns need to get more involved in doing this. You know, you need to do more research and travel around to these different countries and meet with the monks and talk to them, and, you know, you need to get involved because we can't do this. And he said that he was donating 50,000 Swiss francs to help us, because you obviously, he said, you can't go with a begging bowl when you go traveling to talk to all these people. So he donated 50,000 Swiss francs. It's like $30,000 or something. I mean, quite a bit of money. His own money. So then Trungpa Sajjen, this is in August, so then she writes to a few of us because we have, you know, she said we have to have a committee of Western bhikkhunis, okay? And so we have to, you know, have a little committee. So there's, who there is, okay, it's her, and she's in Germany. Then there's Venerable Lecce Somo, who's a professor in San Diego. Then there's Venerable Tenzin Palmo, who's in Tashrijan in India. There's me. I think that's all for the big show. Oh, and Venerable Pema Chodron, but she's in retreat, so she can't kind of be real active with us. So there's five of us, and then Betsy Knapper, who is this brilliant woman, you know, scholar and practitioner, who was very active in the Tibetan Nuns Project and got Dommeling Nunnery up and going, and that's where the nuns are doing the philosophy studies and, you know, approaching to the level where, you know, that's where some of the first Geshe-mas are going to come out of that nunnery and some of the other nunneries. Okay, so Betsy's active in it. She's not a nun. And then we have a Venerable Heng Ching, who's an advisor. She's a nun in Taiwan, a senior nun who's also a professor. And she was also the one who helped Lecce and I when we both went to Taiwan. And Venerable Heng Ching met me at the airport and, you know, gave me Chinese robes and put me on the bus. And she's incredibly kind. This was 1986. I don't think I've seen her since then. Anyway, so she's kind of our advisor, and we're going to ask Venerable William to be our advisor. Okay, so then, the Department of Religious and Cultural Affairs, because since His Holiness said this in June, they decided, well, we need to do something. You know, we've got to kind of get the ball rolling here. So then they called Venerable Tenzin Palmo and Betsy, who came and met with them and talked some about, you know, about it. and trying to think, well, how can we do this? You know, because should we really work and see if we can get the Tibetans to accept the Dharmaguptaka lineage of the nuns, you know, so that we can have a dual ordination, monks from the Tibetan community, nuns from the Dharmaguptaka lineage, and give it that way? Or is it possible, you know, for the monks alone to give it in the Mula Srivastava Vinaya lineage in Tibet? Because, you know, some of the research has shown that in the Pali Vinaya, there is a statement that the Buddha said, monks, I permit you to ordain nuns. It says very clearly in there. That statement, I don't know if it's in the Mula Srivastava Vinaya. It may not be. Okay? But there's no prohibition for the monks doing it. But for the nuns to be able to get the Bhikshuni lineage, they first have to take this intermediate ordination. They have the novice one, which the monks have been giving. Then they're supposed to take this other one called Shikshamana, which is an intermediate ordination that they keep for 2 years, and that's basically to see that you're not pregnant. You know, because it would be terribly embarrassing if you took from America and Bhikshuni in the same day, and, you know, from before you got ordained, you know, you were pregnant. So they have this intermediate ordination. But, well, the nuns are supposed to give that to the Sram Americas, and we don't have a nuns community to give it, and can the monks give it, and everything. So there's one Geshe who's been at Domaling, you know, the nunnery in outside of Dharamsala. And he's written a 27-page paper, which is in Tibetan. We are looking for a translator, desperately looking for a translator to put it into English. But this monk who wrote it, he's a Geshe from Sarajay, is very supportive of the Bhikshuni lineage. And he said that he found some way, some quotation somewhere, that said that it's okay for the monks to give this Shikshamana lineage, Shikshamana ordination. And then we've come up with some different arguments, which I won't go into the technicalities of, you know, I don't know if you're interested in it, but the Vinaya technicalities, with some of us Westerners, of why it should be okay for the monks to give it in the Mula Srivastava lineage. So then, you know, we're trying to see, well, what's the most skillful way to work with this? And then we're told by the Department of Religion and Culture that they want to have a meeting with His Holiness and all the abbots and geshes and lamas, they do this periodically, and present a proposal to them about reinstituting the Bhikshuni lineage. And they want all of our input because they have to come up with the proposal. And they want to have a meeting. It was going to be in April or maybe May. They don't have a date for it yet. You know how things are. And so they want to meet with the Committee of Western Bhikshunis, you know, who just got formed, and, you know, we just write over email, and we all live in different continents. Except Lekshe and I, we're at least in North America, but, you know, she's near Mexico and I'm near Canada. So then, you know, and then when he went to Domaling to their inauguration in December, again he brought up the thing about the Bhikshuni lineage. So 3 times this year, in public, he's talked about it. So, you know, So we, the Bhikshunis, have to get a strategy devised, and we have to get all of our ducks in a row, you know, all of our, you know, in this chapter and verse in Vinaya it says this, and in this chapter and verse in Vinaya it says this, and historically this, and historically that, because, you know, the monks want everything, you know, you gotta meet them on their own terms, you know, and so, you know, we have to get this together because they want to have this meeting with us soon, and then a meeting in the springtime with all the lamas and geshes and everybody. So we're emailing back and forth, and we're going, we gotta meet, we gotta meet, we gotta meet. Where are we gonna meet? Okay, everybody come to Dharamsala in the beginning of June. Oh, well, that's hard and that's difficult. June's too late. Everybody come to New York. Oh, you know, I'm here. I can't go to New York. And da, 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 da. So, guess where we're going to meet? Here. Isn't that incredible? So I am just, you know, kind of, because I thought, you know, that I just wasn't going to be able to go because I couldn't go to New York, and and they just decided, you know, let's just come. I was just like thrilled. I mean, it is so auspicious to have this kind of meeting here, you know, and then and to have these kind of people come to the Abbey. Unfortunately, Venerable Tenzin Palmo can't come, and Betsy can't come. And Venerable Han Ching and Venerable Lecture Somero and Venerable Champa Sejun are going to come. So it's going to be four of us. We're going to, you know, have Venerable Tenzin Palmo on one or two conference calls, you know. And so this is going to happen here at the Abbey. Okay. One of them is arriving the evening of March 15th, and the other two are arriving March 16th. They're all staying until the 19th. So this is in a matter of weeks. And isn't that totally amazing? Yeah. And you know what was so amazing is like several months, maybe it must have been back in August or September, I was writing to the editor of the Mandala saying, you know, this is kind of, I should write an article about this and, you know, get it out. And she said, no. Basically, nobody's interested. And it'll make Tibetan Buddhism look bad because it'll make it look like they discriminate against women. And so, you know, completely disinterested. And I was so surprised because I'm looking at this and this is so historic. You know, I mean, this, it's totally historic. And it is so important. I mean, women are half the population in this world. And having a Bhikshuni Sangha in the Tibetan tradition is going to bolster the tradition so much. I mean, you're going to have this whole group of educated women who can teach and can lead in society, and how it's going to influence Buddhism in the West, having a community of fully ordained nuns. I mean, it's so important for the survival of the Dharma. And I'm looking at it as, you know, this is so historic. And the editors of Buddhist magazines are going, yeah, you know, send us something juicy, you know, who have you been sexually abused by? You know, I'm sure if the nuns wanted to, you know, do a tell-all article about sexual abuse, I mean, we'd have all the Buddhist magazines knocking on our doors to interview us, you know, but trying to do something virtuous? Anyway, you just go ahead and do it. And so we're going to meet here, try and devise a strategy. You know, those who can meet, you know, with them in Dharamsala will go to that meeting and present it, and we'll see what happens. Yeah, but I think we all need to make prayers for this to happen, because this kind of thing depends on the karma of so many people. You know, it's like when you have something happening that can benefit a large number of people, it depends on the karma of all those people. Yeah, it's like the Abbey, starting an Abbey. It's not just the karma of a few people. It's the karma of all the people who have the opportunity to benefit in one way or another from this Abbey. You know, everybody has to create merit to make it happen. And so same with, you know, instituting the full ordination in the tradition. Anyway, I was just going to talk about that for a few minutes. I don't know how long I'm Before I go on to the talk, do you have any questions about this particular topic? Yeah.
What do you think about the Tibetan community in terms of, since this happened,
mm-hmm.
Seems like they're in so much flux. That might be the problem, because they're in, you know, not so much in Tibet in the beginning, but I'm just thinking about the Tibetans that are scattered all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
They seem like doing their role to, you know, to find. This is going to be quite a change.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how they would interpret it in terms of their own cultural survival.
Yeah. Well, I think this is why, you know, one. Okay, so your question is how, from the Tibetan perspective, would the women feel in terms of their cultural survival, because this is a big change. And I think that's one of the reasons why there hasn't been much push for it before, is because the Tibetans feel so much, well, we've got to stay together as a community and we can't have anything that has dissension in it. But actually, I think that it will really bolster the community, because if you have bhikshunis, and you know, and you give the Tibetan nuns more confidence, and they begin to teach, that's going to strengthen the whole society, you know, because they're going to teach the mothers primarily, and the mothers are the ones who are the first ones who teach the kids.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch, and you mentioned about the Tibetans being in diaspora, you know, they have so, in Western countries, the kids don't know anything about the Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
They know very little. They go to a Losar ceremony and that's about it. You know, at Deer Park, we see them on His Holiness's birthday, and that's about it. You know, but and a few other major ceremonies. But you know, but if you have bhikshunis who are going out into the community and teaching the lay people, men and women, then the kids are going to learn. Then there's going to be less of a chance of the Christian missionaries going in and converting them, and it's going to, I think, really strengthen their Tibetan identity. You know, that's the way I see it. Of course, they're seeing it as, oh, well, change, and, you know, change is, like, scary, you know, because they've had a lot of it that they haven't chosen. But I think it would be so beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's so much they've learned in the home.
Exactly.
The more educated the mothers are,
exactly,
the more their whole culture will be able to carry on.
Yep. Yep. And you have, like,
in,
and you have, like, in South India now, there's the monasteries, and there's a lot of lay people living around there. The monks do not go to the lay communities and give teachings. They say because the lay people don't invite them. What I think would be great is, you know, you have women, you know, the nuns who are bhikshunis, they go teach the lay people. You know? It will be. It will strengthen the whole community in India. Right? So,
I think it will also give the young women of the Tibet communities an option, rather than either being married or whatever else the other option is there, to be a single working woman in the system too, to give them an education and give them an opportunity to practice their spiritual tradition, which they have.
And aren't a lot of the Tibetans that are in India getting educated, girls and boys?
Yeah.
The Indian public
right, education? They're getting educated in the Indian public school system. But, and then there's the TCV schools. But they aren't learning a lot of Dharma, even in the Tibetan Children's Village schools. They don't learn much about Buddhism. They'll say a prayer to Manjushri. But they, you know. So that's why I think it could be very good. Yeah.
So when His Holiness has a ceremony for women that are going to go,
that's the Shaman Erica. That's the novice ordination.
I don't understand who has the right to give those.
Okay, so to give the Shramanerika ordination, the women's novice ordination, actually what's quite interesting is the Chinese say that has to be given by the nuns. It's not supposed to be given by the monks.
Mm-hmm.
in the Chinese system, both the novice ordination and then the intermediate ordination are given by the nuns, not the monks. And only the full ordination is given by both of them. But the Tibetans, because they never had fully ordained nuns, they said, well, we'll give the novice ordination. It's the same vows as giving it to the monks. You know, it's the same 10 vows. So yeah, so they have that tradition there, and that's what they do. And that's what people, when people go to take their ordination in Dharamsala or wherever, that's what they're taking for the women.
And then do some people stay with that level, and that's all they ever do?
Yeah. A lot of people stay at that level. Like I said, I was there for 9 years because I didn't even know that you could go to Taiwan and take it. And it was Venerable Lekshya Soma who really encouraged me to do that. And then what's quite interesting is, just to talk about the kind of resistance and everything, in 1998, when they were having this dual ordination ceremony in Bodh Gaya, none of the Western nuns came, and the Tibetan nuns didn't come either. And we were told that there was a rumor going around that His Holiness said not to come. Well, Venerable Lekshya Soma has a letter, I saw it, because she'd written His Holiness beforehand asking if people could go, and he said yes. But you have what you have, because some of the monks who are abbots of, and this is also true of the Western nuns, you know, some of their teachers, the monks don't know about the Bhikshuni ordination. The Galupa tradition sometimes is extremely conservative about this. The Kagyus and Nyingma Sakya are a little bit more flexible. But the Gelu quite conservative. And so the monks don't know about it. They don't know, is it this, is it that? So then they don't encourage the nuns to go and do it. And so then as a result, even some of the Western nuns, they're a little bit, well, you know, well, why should we do this? And what's quite interesting, because our confession ceremony is supposed to be, you know, the monks do it alone and the women do it alone, because some of your vows entail, you know, things that you might want to speak about in a unisex community. So in Dharamsala, when they have it, because there's no fully ordained nuns, the nuns go with monks. Okay, so the bhikshus are having it, and then you go in halfway through and do your Shramanera confession and then leave. And it's all the little boys, because they're the ones who are the Shramaneras in the Tibetan tradition. So you have all the little boys, and they go in first, they rush into the temple and trip. And then the women, you know, are on the outside, the nuns are all on the outside, you know, doing their confession to the monks on the outside of the temple, because not the temple's too small for everybody to fit in. Well, when we have the confession ceremony, sometimes in different places, when we have enough bhikshunis together, then we invite the lay women, not the Shramanerikas, to come along. And in some places they will, because they're really excited about it. But some of the Western Shramanerikas are a little bit like, well, our teachers haven't given us permission, and we don't know, and we're so used to doing it with the monks, we're not sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very interesting to see how, yeah, the hesitation that people have. You know, because there's so much about you know, listening to your teacher and the authority of the teacher and so on.
Yeah. So as far as the Bhikshuni, when you talk about how it changed your practice, I mean, that would be so much of the inspiration for women to really think about it more seriously. What, besides mm-hmm. just the historical value of this, uh-huh. as far as the practice of the monastic, the nuns, what does it actually change?
So what does it change in you? For me, a few things. I think the major thing was I realized that I had to grow up, you know, because as a Shramanerika, you're a junior member, you know, you don't have the responsibility for perpetuating the Dharma and perpetuating the Vinaya, you know. But when you're a Bhikshu or Bhikshuni, you have that responsibility. And I've always felt like you know, we have the Dharma and the Vinaya lineage as this state because of all these generations of people who have practiced century after century, and all of their practice created this huge wave, and this wave is moving forward. And suddenly, when I took Bhikshuni ordination, I'm responsible for continuing this wave. I'm a full member of the Sangha. I'm not a junior member. You know, I've got to keep my vows well. I've got to make sure this tradition lasts and goes into the future, because it's too precious to just do my own trick or to let it fall into obscurity. So I realized, wow, I have to grow up in my practice. You know, so it really changed my level of confidence. It changed my level of feeling responsibility for the survival of the Dharma into future generations. I went to Taiwan, and they give the ordination there in a 1 month training program, which is so beneficial, you know. And just being in this environment with these strong nuns, because the Taiwanese bhikshunis are really strong, and actually there's more of them than there are of the bhikshus. Yeah, they way outnumber the bhikshus. But just seeing these women who were like so active and strong and doing things was just tremendous, you know, because the Tibetan nuns are so shy and so demure, and they're just beginning to, you know, kind of like in 1986 when they came to life as a Western Buddhist nun and saw us asking our teachers questions. They had never seen, you know, the nuns asking teachers questions. They just don't do that. Yeah? And I mean, when I first ordained, I tried to copy the image of the Tibetan nuns and be sweet. As you can see, it didn't work. I tried, and it just didn't work. You know? But, so then there is, with the full ordination, there's an avenue for your energy and for your creativity to go forth. Yeah? And, I mean, just an incredible internal shift of, you know, now I've got to be a grown up, I've got to be responsible. I have to practice harder. Yeah?
And that the Bhikshuni lineage in the Tibet tradition is being held right now by like 5 Western monastic Bhikshuni.
Yeah.
That's a huge responsibility.
And we're not, you know, considered.
And you're not considered by the Tibetans.
Says, yeah.
Not holding up anything.
Yeah, right. You know, individually, our teachers have all said, oh, wonderful, marvelous. But when they come together, everybody is so afraid to be the first one to speak out in favor of something different. You know? It's very interesting to watch.
Maybe somebody to translate the documentation that this Geshe was...
Yeah, that this Geshe did, you know. You have a translator, do you know Tibetan?
I have one question. Well, Alex or Jaga, can they do it?
It's a possibility. You know, I don't know, neither of them have the Vinaya vocabulary, but at this point we'll take anybody. But whether they have the time to do it. Yeah? That's the thing. I mean, I would love if one of them did it.
What about Venerable Dhamkha? Isn't she studying with any of them?
Yeah, I was thinking of writing to her. I don't know if she has time.
Yeah.
But because she's on a... Yeah, she's on a Fulbright, so... Yeah, I wonder if he would do it. It's an idea. I could write to Geshe Kyanam.
That was not my question. The question is, as a non Eastern Jew or those who have taken the Bhikshuni ordination, do you have to have permission from your teacher or not?
To take the ordination?
To take the ordination, the full ordination.
The full ordination. Yeah, what happens is your Vinaya master, you know, some senior who's usually your teacher is the one who presents you to the Sangha. So I think most of the people have gone and asked one of their teachers for permission before taking it. And so that's why I said individually the Tibetans will give the permission to do it. Yeah. Uh-huh.
No matter what your age is, do you still have to do that 2-year
intermediate? Okay, so the 2-year thing, the Shiksamana ordination. The way the Chinese did that is they kind of had stopped giving it. I think they may have started giving it again, but they kind of had stopped giving it because in the Dharmaguptaka, the vows, there's six, that ordination has 6 vows, and the 6 vows are the same as the Shamanerika vows. So in the Tibetan tradition, in the Mulushavastivada, the vows for the Shiksamana are different. But in the Chinese, they're the same. So they kind of stopped giving it as a separate ordination, and they kept the people in the temple as Shamanerikas, or as lay women, for 2 or more years. And then they considered that to be, you know, to fulfill the requirement. I didn't do the Shiksamana, no. I had been the Shamanerika for 9 years. Yeah. So they considered that good enough.
So would it be possible if the Tibetan monks, the bhikshus, thought the same way as the Sri Lankan bhikshus thought about the Sri Lankan monks, that they could simply make a decision?
Yes.
And say, this is an exception. This is an extraordinary exception. We should implement the bhikshuni lineage into our tradition.
Yeah, have the Dharmaguptaka nuns and the Tibetan monks give it, and give it, have them take the Mulushavastivada. So this is one of the things that we want to talk about and see, you know, can we make a case that the monks can't refute, that will, you know, be acceptable to them? Yeah, and then you know, because for a long time it was, well, we need to do everything according to Vinaya, because the Theravadas are always saying, oh, you know, these Vajrayana people, they don't keep strict Vinaya, so we have to make sure if we do the Bhikshuni lineage, you know, that everything. So that we don't get criticized by the Theravada. And then here the Sri Lankans have gone ahead and done it. But not many of the Tibetans know that. There's not a lot of communication among the traditions, you know. People don't know what's going on in each other's communities much.
Maybe it doesn't have to happen with all of the different traditions, then. It could just happen within the Tibetan alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's quite different.
Right. Right. And so it seems to me also much more realistic that the Tibetans just work on their own tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, His Holiness still wants to have an international conference, and I think we'll talk about it here too, because Venerable Lekshya has a lot of good connections in Taiwan, as does Venerable Heng Ching. And actually, they thought, let's have an international conference, not necessarily to decide this, as His Holiness was proposing, but to discuss it and to choose very carefully who we invite. Because the Tibetans had a conference a few years back, they invited the most conservative of the Chinese monks, and one Chinese monk said, don't rely on our lineage. And so that's who everybody quotes now. You know, one Chinese monk said, don't, you know, we're not sure about our lineage for the nuns. So that's who everybody quotes, not the thousands who say yes. So, where was I?
So the international,
right, yeah, so discussing it. So they had actually some university and some Buddhist societies in Taiwan offered to sponsor it, and they invited His Holiness. And His Holiness, this was just recently in the last few months, and His Holiness had to say, because they wanted to have it in Taiwan, he had to say, because they're trying to have some negotiations non-public negotiations with Beijing, and he was saying this would endanger that for him to go publicly to Taiwan for a conference. So now they're trying to think of maybe another place to have the conference. Yeah. Just as a thing of discussing it.
You said that you sort of feel like you're outside of the Tibetan religious
institution.
And then, so as far as, I mean, I don't know where you stand on, like, you know, American Buddhism or things like that, but as far as having a certain number of Western bhikshunis, and then presumably there are Western bhikshus who could also do this together. And
That actually has been my thought for some time, because now, you know, there's several of us Western nuns who have had the full ordination long enough whereby we can give it, okay? And if we can get some monks together with us, then we can go ahead and give the ordination. And the Tibetans probably wouldn't say a whole lot, you know? If as long as we don't do it there and it's not with their nuns, I don't think it'll, And when you look historically, this is kind of how Buddhism spread from country to country. People just went and did it. You know? They didn't always have conferences and things like that. You just... So, here in the West, we can go ahead and do it. But for the benefit of the Tibetan nuns.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's quite important.
Is there any influence on the bhikshus in this? The Western bhikshus, like, do they think about this?
I don't know. I haven't talked with a lot of them about it. I think most of them would be supportive, relatively. Yeah.
When in the West, it will be a reality. I mean, there are many more women than men.
Yeah.
So, nuns and monks.
Okay.